reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We'll call our third case of the day, 2004 AP 1359, Kenneth J. Yorgan versus Thomas W. Durkin. Mr. Yorgan, representing yourself, you have 12 and a half minutes, and it will show on the time. And Andrew Erlandson, representing the Wisconsin Chiropractic Association, has 12 and a half minutes. Then Mr. Becker will have 30 minutes, and Mr. Erlandson, you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Yorgan, you may proceed.
Okay. May it please the Court, I'm Dr. Kenneth Yorgan. I'm 59 years old, and I've been a practicing chiropractor for about 23 years now. I'm an old-school chiropractor, one who entered the profession after having been helped as a patient in high school. But coming from a working-class family with no financial resources to go to college, I went to work in industry. In 1969, I ruptured two discs in my lumbar spine while employed as a longshoreman in the port of Milwaukee. Several years later, while living in St. Louis, Missouri, I realized I was qualified for educational assistance through the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation. While in college, I served as class president during my first two semesters and later as student body president. My motivation has always been service to others while earning a modest living for myself, which is why I'm one of the small number of doctors who participate in both the Medicare and Medicaid programs. I've also always been liberal about extending credit to personal injury victims who need services but lack the financial resources to pay for them in a timely manner. During my years in practice, I've provided care to a fair number of such individuals on credit, secured by their making an assignment to me against any potential recovery they might be able to secure from a libel party. Almost always, there has been an attorney managing the injured party's claim, yet there have been times where problems have arisen over being paid the fees for my service. Twice in St. Louis while I practiced there, and four times in Wisconsin. Sad to say, in each instance, the attorney appeared to be the basis of the problem. I had to abandon one case in St. Louis, as it happened just as I was leaving the area. Three cases were resolved through persistence, persuasion, and sometimes the threat of legal action. Two have required legal action. This is the second. I know from conversations with other doctors that this problem is not unique to me. My case is representative of what many have experienced. This is an annoying, distractive, costly, recurrent, and unnecessary problem. A doctor who provides care to an injured party on credit secured by an assignment should not have to sue anyone and end up taking the plea all the way to the Supreme Court. It is unfair, unnecessary, and can easily be resolved here and now with no need for an expensive, protracted, and contentious legislative process.
Counselor, are you aware of whether Attorney Durkin knew of the written assignment before he distributed the proceeds of the settlement?
Yes, he was aware, and I was going to cover that in just a little bit. Please indulge me. This is my
first. Doctors don't generally argue before us.
Certainly, it is the Court's prerogative to make its own decision in this matter, but existing laws, statutes, and precedents certainly allow and encourage it to rule as I am petitioning it to. In my petition for review, I've asked the Court to consider two questions. First, is it possible for an assignment of benefits to be made against the potential settlement of a liability claim? Can an injured person without adequate financial resources to pay for needed care make a promise to a care provider that they will be paid from the proceeds of a liability claim? And can that promise be enforced against the attorney who is acting as the fiduciary agent for that injured party? The second question is, should care providers, under the circumstances just given in the first question, be considered interested third parties as described in the language of Supreme Court Rule 20:1.15? As to the first question, can an assignment of benefits be made? If the answer is yes, then this Court will reverse the appeals court decision and reinstate the circuit court decision. Because under the standard described by the appeals court, such assignments can be easily subverted and rendered ineffective. When it overturned the circuit court's decision, the appeals court stated that in order for an assignment to be enforceable against an attorney, that attorney must not simply be aware that his or her client had executed an assignment, but the attorney must countersign it. Such a standard opens the door for anyone who wishes to subvert an assignment to do so with little effort and leave assignees, care providers who have extended credit to injured parties, with no protection of their fees, and no recourse other than legal action against the assignor, the original injured party, which may or may not result in recovery. I say this because even if an attorney commonly signs an assignment, there is nothing to prevent a claimant from switching to an attorney who will not honor the assignment. My understanding is that it wasn't always the case that attorneys acted as fiduciary agents in personal liability claims. There was a time when liable parties or their insurance companies would remit settlement monies directly to the injured parties for them to disperse in whatever way they needed or wanted to. When too many of those claimants failed to pay their attorneys, legislation was lobbied for and enacted that made the attorneys the fiduciary agents for these cases. Now, I don't know because I wasn't privy to the discussions that took place in the legislature, and I don't have transcripts of them. But I'd be willing to gamble that at least a part of the argument for the attorneys for this change was that they could be relied upon to be more responsible with settlement monies than many claimants had shown themselves to be. So now attorneys receive the settlement money, take their portion, pay any interested parties who have legitimate claims against the settlement, and remit the remainder to their client. At least that's the way it's intended to work. I know that's the intent because I've read the Supreme Court rules. We are here today because that policy does not always get followed. 6 years ago, I provided care to a young woman who had been injured in a motor vehicle accident because she had no financial resources to pay for the care she needed, and she clearly had a legitimate claim against a liable party who carried insurance, and she had an attorney representing her. I accepted an assignment of a portion of the monetary settlement that she would likely receive in exchange for forbearance of collecting my fees from her. During the time that she was receiving care and prior to her settlement, she changed attorneys and ultimately came to be represented by Mr. Thomas Durkin. It has been established that Mr. Durkin was notified of my treatment of his client and that she had assigned a portion of any potential settlement to me. I refer you to points 4, 5, and 6 on page 3 of Plaintiff Respondent's Brief dated October 5, 2004, submitted to the District 2 Appeals Court. However, despite having received settlement money for this case sometime in June of 2003, Mr. Durkin has not as yet remitted to me that portion of the settlement that his client assigned to me, to which no one but myself has legal claim. He paid himself, and he paid the attorney who referred this case to him, who had originally received the case on my referral, but he hasn't paid me. You don't no doubt know that this case has gone through small claims court, where judgment was granted in my favor, and through the appeals court, where that judgment was overturned. While I was initially stunned by the appeals court decision, I was prepared to accept it as simply an instance of my instinctive understanding of right and wrong being in conflict with laws and legal precedent. That is, until I read the cases upon which the appeals court based its decision. After locating the cases and struggling through the language, I arrived at the facts. What I discovered was that the appeals court had gotten it wrong. That encouraged me to file a motion for review with this court, and because you have graciously consented to do that, here we are. Would you hold up that first sign? One of the cases that the appeals court relied on as supportive of their decision to overturn the lower court's judgment in favor of Yorgan is Lehner versus USA. In this case, Lehner is suing HUD to stop their foreclosure on her property, a hospital upon which they held a mortgage that she had failed to pay. Lehner contended that she had made an assignment of Medi-Cal funds due to her hospital to HUD and that HUD therefore had no right to foreclose. But Lehner could not establish that HUD had accepted the alleged assignment. In fact, Lehner's hospital had been kicked out of the Medi-Cal program and was owed no money from it. So the court dismissed the case in favor of defendant HUD because no assignment had been accepted by them. This cleared the way for them to continue their foreclosure action. In Yorgan versus Durkin, if you'd hold that one up, the plaintiff holds the same position that HUD does in Lehner. Hernandez made an assignment to Yorgan of funds she expected to collect from a liable party. Yorgan accepted the assignment. It's not up to Durkin to accept or reject the assignment. He's Hernandez's fiduciary, her legal agent. One of his responsibilities as such is to properly disperse any money he receives on her behalf. The law that gave him the power to pay himself also gave him the responsibility to pay others. Another of the cases cited by the appeals court is Berkowitz versus Haygood, a New Jersey case, which is almost exactly parallel to Yorgan versus Durkin. Remember, the appeals court is using these cases as supportive of its opinion that an attorney must countersign an assignment in order for it to be effective against him or her. But that did not happen in Berkowitz. And that court ruled, quote, since the client has the power to validly assign the proceeds, the attorney has the obligation to honor such an assignment if properly notified, which is the same standard that is established by Wisconsin Statute 13.488, paragraph 1, subparagraph K, where it states the power and duty of an assignment is made enforceable, quote, upon receipt of notice. The similarities between Berkowitz and Yorgin are striking. Both cases, a chiropractor is suing an attorney for failure to honor an assignment. The dollar amounts are very close, and both attorneys replaced other attorneys who had managed the case at an earlier time. The second question I requested that this court consider is, should care providers under the circumstances given in the first question be considered interested parties as described in the language of Supreme Court Rule 20:1.15? I can't imagine how they wouldn't be. The fees for the care they provide are an essential part of an injured party's claim in these cases, and they have been assigned a portion of the proceeds from any settlement the claimant achieves. I think it's abundantly evident that they are interested third parties, but some confusion apparently exists because the circuit court, quote, is not holding, unquote, that Durkin had violated the rule when he failed to protect Yorgin's interests. Certainly there's a distinction between declaring someone innocent of a violation and not holding them guilty, and perhaps the lower court was simply avoiding the actual question. Clarification of the Supreme Court's rule on this matter would be helpful in avoiding future conflicts. Thank you for allowing me to read that.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Yorgin.
Do you have any questions?
I have a question. You said there was a change of attorneys.
Yes.
The first attorney, did he in any way or she send you a letter saying that you would be protected on your fee? On your bill?
No, actually, her first attorney, she was treating with me when she had this first attorney. She expressed dissatisfaction with him, asked if I knew another attorney. I referred her to a friend of mine who is just down the street from me, and he's an excellent personal injury attorney. He always honors assignments. He was given the assignment. He then referred the case to Mr. Becker's office because a conflict of interest arose in his representation of Sal Hernandez and her mother. So they were given the choice of one of them going to another firm. Sal Hernandez went to Mr. Becker's office, and I'm assuming that Mr. Becker handed the case off to Thomas Durkin.
Did you ever have any correspondence with Mr. Durkin whereby he indicated he'd protect you on your bill?
He was provided a copy of the lien in the records, and he confirmed that he had received the lien. The language on my certification of records lists an inventory of items that are contained in the records, and at the bottom it says, please confirm that you have received these items by remitting a check in the below amount. He did send me a check, thereby confirming that he had received all of the contents that I had listed, and the lien was one of those things listed.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yorgin.
Thank you.
Mr. Erlinson.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Andrew Erlinson of the law firm Hurley, Burrish & Stanton, appearing as counsel for Amicus Curiae, Wisconsin Chiropractic Association. I would begin by noting some important points about what this case is not. This is not a situation where the patient slash client and the medical provider's intent is unclear. This is not a case where the intent to create an assignment and a lien on settlement proceeds or the proceeds of any verdict or judgment is unclear. There isn't a dispute, a credible dispute, that the patient client's attorney didn't receive notice of the lien or assignment. And there is no evidence that the patient client ever expressed dissatisfaction with Dr. Yorgin's services or challenged the legality or enforceability of the assignment lien document in any way.
Counselor, I noticed that you use assignment and lien interchangeably, and to me, legally, they are quite different items. And I know the document uses both terms. Do you want to tell me what you think this is? Is it an assignment or is it a lien?
I think it's both, Your Honor. An assignment is a transfer of property interest. A lien is a granting of a property right. If a person or a chiropractor or any medical provider in Dr. Yorgin's shoes is attempting to enforce a lien per se, then the cause of action is actually against the liened property. And anyone who possesses the property or claims an interest in the property might be a necessary party. Here, the claim isn't exactly a foreclosure claim. What it really is a claim for conversion by dispossession of the property. Dr. Jorgen's claim is that the property was rightfully mine. I had a lien on it. You had notice of it, and you transferred it to somebody who didn't have an interest in the property anymore, or whose interest in the property was subservient to my lienor's interest. Now, the other, an assignment clearly is a very different thing. An assignment is an assignment of rights in the property, not necessarily a right to possess or an equity interest that encumbers the property. It doesn't change the claim appreciably, in my view, on these facts, because Dr. Jorgen, as the assignee of Ms. Hernandez's interest in these settlement proceeds, again, has an interest that was interfered with by the disposition of the settlement proceeds in toto.
Let me tell you what I see the difference as. If you had a lien on property, and that property is transferred to a third party, it can buzz right along to the third party, and the lien remains on the property unless someone has taken it off. If you have an assignment, you have ownership rights in it, and you can't lawfully transfer its ownership to another party, or at least that's the distinction I see.
And I appreciate that distinction, and it's particularly critical here where the property disappears. The property is in the possession of somebody who can't be contacted and located in order to assert a foreclosure claim on the property. So you're left with your assignee's interest, which was notice to the person who possessed the property and then dispossessed the property. That person had notice of Dr. Jorgen's assignee's interest. And so the claim then is also a claim for conversion because the attorney's action dispossessed Dr. Jorgen of the property, and it substantially interfered with his ability to enjoy the benefits of the assignment.
Mr. Erlinson, in handling the trust account, Mr. Durkin handling the trust account, what fiduciary duty, if any, did he owe with respect to that trust account and to who?
I think that the attorney held and owed a duty to both parties. Once receiving notice of an assignment, the attorney is an obligor, but not an obligor in a contractual sense per se. Funds are held in trust because they're not the attorney's property. They're the client's property. The attorney's duty to handle those and disperse those funds is really a ministerial duty. So that was the Lieberman Court's mistake, was looking and viewing the attorney as the assignee of a duty, as opposed to the chiropractor as the assignee of a right. And I think that the problem was one of syntax, because duties are delegated, rights are assigned, and so in the sense that the duty to transfer the funds, which were Ms. Hernandez's funds, the duty to transfer those funds to Dr. Jorgen was delegated, in a sense, but it was really Ms. Hernandez's right to receive those proceeds from her settlement, which were held in the trust account, that was assigned to Dr. Jorgen.
What was, once again, I want to focus on the attorney. What was the attorney's duty, if any, fiduciary duty, if any, and where did that duty lie in handling the trust account? Did it lie to Dr. Jorgen? Did it lie to Ms. Hernandez? Where does any duty lie for that? Because I think that may impact on how we should look at the case.
It certainly does. The duty that an attorney owes is to the client. And the client in this case had made an unequivocal and unrevoked assignment that was clear. And so the attorney's duty is to follow the instructions of the client. And in managing a trust account, certainly the instructions of the client are paramount. And here the instructions were pay Dr. Jorgen. And it was pursuant to an assignment agreement. And so in the sense of the attorney had a right under the law, or had a duty under the law to Dr. Jorgen, but in terms of an ethical duty as trustee, his duty initially is to follow his client's instructions. And when there has been an assignment, and attorney Durkin is duty-bound to disperse funds, which he was, if he's on notice of the assignment, and it's never been revoked or called into question by the client, his duty is to follow his client's instructions. And so, in the contractual common law sense and the ethical sense, the duties are the same. But that's not to say that in some circumstances the duties might not conflict.
What's the source of the duty you're talking about?
The assignment agreement between, well, duty, I believe in Justice Butler's, in that context, the duty falls on an attorney under the rules of professional responsibility to manage a trust account. Duty in the legal sense, which creates a right of action that runs in favor of Dr. Jorgen, comes under the common law of assignments. And so what allows Dr. Jorgen to assert a direct right of action is the assignment of rights. But that's a separate, though entirely related in this case, duty, which Attorney Durkin owes to his client. And I guess I would illustrate the difference, the subtle distinction, by changing the facts. If Ms. Hernandez had called into question the validity of the assignment, then Attorney Durkin's duty would continue to run to his client, and as long as there was a dispute, he would have to hold those funds in trust or take some other action, but certainly not disperse them while the dispute was ongoing. Because the legal duty to pay the funds to to Dr. Jorgen would not be settled. And Ms. Hernandez had called that duty into question. And until it's settled, Attorney Durkin is best served by observing the professional rules that say keep those funds in trust until the dispute is resolved or pay them into court.
Mr. Erlandson, was there a dispute here in regard to the amount of the bill? It's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Mr. Durkin contacted Dr. Jorgen, wanted to see if there could be a compromise in regard to the bill, was told no, Dr. Jorgen would not compromise the bill, and at that point apparently turned the money over to his client. Am I correct in that regard?
I believe that Dr. Jorgen was certainly contacted asking to compromise his bill, and he declined to do so. Whether that stemmed from expediency in trying to get the matter closed and bring everybody closer together, or whether there was a dispute as to reasonableness and necessity, I'm not sure. I didn't pick that up from the record, but what is clear from the record, as I understand it, is that Ms. Hernandez never called into question reasonableness or necessity or amount, and that the effort to get a compromise was an effort to resolve this amicably without ending up in the highest court of the state.
The attorney got settlement funds, right? What was in the agreement when the settlement funds were provided with the attorney? What was part of the settlement agreement when the attorney got money? What was the understanding that he would do with the money?
Well, under the assignment language, Ms. Hernandez's instructions to the attorney.
But what were the instructions from the group that gave him the money?
I'm not aware of what, if any, instructions there were, whether there was a general release granted or whether it was contemplated that the funds would be dispersed.
So that's not in this picture.
Correct. In our view, it's not, and I don't think there's anything in the record on it.
Okay, so we're only dealing with the three of them, and there's no outsider. And when you say trust, we don't know what the arrangements were for him to get the money.
True. Typically, the funds are received in trust in these cases, as I understand it, because they're client funds, and unless and until the matter's settled, that's where they're held. Whether it was in a drawer or a different account, I'm not sure. I don't know that that's...
Probably it would be in a trust account.
Indeed. Agreed.
Also, just excluding the statute of frauds, or perhaps including it, because I know that your opposing counsel had raised that in his brief... I don't think there's any argument about notice here, but what concerns me is you had a degree of pass-off. Dr. Jorgen gave this to a friend attorney. The friend attorney determined that he had a conflict of interest. He then passes it off to somebody, and let's say we exaggerate the situation, we have another pass-off, we simply have this document in the record. And I don't know if I'm troubled, but when you have the statute of frauds, which I may or may not say that there should be acceptance in writing, it seems to me that it's a situation that's created that maybe the obligations and rights are not completely understood, and that's what I think the chief was raising as far as just who said what to whom? And that, do you have a response to that?
I do, because I think it goes to the core problem with the Riegelman Court's decision, and that is its use of the term assignee, and its placing of the assignee's hat on the attorney. The duty to pay is not what was assigned here. The right to receive is what was assigned. And the law is very clear, and there's actually a nice set of citations in the case that was submitted by Attorney Becker recently about the Hornbook Law, and that says that a party has every right to assign his or her benefits under a contract, and once notified of the assignment, the obligor has a duty to act in accordance therewith. And so the obligor doesn't need to sign any acknowledgement. All the obligor needs is notice. I think that the signature line on these assignment and doctor's lien agreements, which includes a signature line for the attorney, is it's wise to have it there because once an attorney signs it, he or she is hard-pressed to claim no notice. But it's not prerequisite to a legal assignment of a right because that's a matter between Ms. Hernandez and Dr. Jorgen. And once the obligor is on notice of it, he or she has a duty to act in accordance with it.
Chief, I know the red light is on, but can I ask?
Justice Butler.
Mr. Erlandson, the one concern that I have, or at least question, not concern, question I have, is whether Riegelman, I know you've asserted that it should be overturned, whether Riegelman even applies under this facts, because Riegelman's a very different fact situation where the attorney did sign something, did send in to the other party. We don't have those facts here. So do we even need to deal with Riegelman at all in terms of the responsibilities that are asserted that are owed in this case, or is this a separate case?
It may not be necessary to overrule Riegelman. However, if it's to be applied and interpreted as the Jorgen v. Durkin Court of Appeals did, if it's going to be extended there, then the line needs to be drawn, because there are different facts there. And that was a situation where the Warshawski Law Firm, they signed on to the agreement. And so much of the analysis in Riegelman sounded in contract as to what was the firm's duties under this agreement that they were all parties to. So in that sense, the facts are very different, and that analysis doesn't apply here. And so technically, no. All that need be done in this case to correct the error below is an overruling of Jorgen v. Durkin, not necessarily extending it to overrule Riegelman. However, Riegelman, to clarify going forward for medical providers and attorneys alike, it might be wise to circumscribe Riegelman or limit it to its facts or distinguish it in a way to make it clear that it was a separate situation.
Thank you, Mr. Erlandson. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Mr. Becker?
Good morning, Justices. My name is John Becker, and I represent Mr. Durkin in this case. And the first thing I'd like to point out is a few things I'd like to summarize. One, I can tell you, in this case, Mr. Durkin was following my direction. Now, with respect to this particular bill, I was on vacation, I came back and was told there was a problem. But I had informed Mr. Durkin when I hired him that I did not believe these liens were valid in Wisconsin. That was my understanding from things I was taught in law school. That's what I was told when I started practicing. I was told that Wisconsin does not have a statutory lien. Other states do. And if I'm wrong, I mean, you'll tell me, I'm sure of that. But that was my understanding, and that's what I had instructed him. So, what I'm not going to address here is a statutory lien. There's no question about that. There's no common law lien. There's no contract here. What I intend to discuss here are equitable liens and assignments. First, with respect to assignments, my argument is, one, you can't assign a personal injury claim. Two, if you can, in this case, the statute of frauds would require it to be signed in writing by the party to whom they want, against whom they want to enforce it. And three, even if the statute of frauds doesn't apply, opposing counsel are talking about duties and rights. This is a duty. Duties are delegated duties have to be assumed.
Counselor, don't we have common law doctrine in the state of Wisconsin that says each and every one of us has a duty to everyone else not to do something which will cause foreseeable harm? Just simple negligence? Isn't that always present?
Well, this isn't a negligence claim. This is a contract claim. It's an assignment.
If your client intentionally tried to do Dr. Jorgen out of whatever rights he might not have, then I assume that it probably is not a negligence claim. But if he mistakenly and negligently paid out on a claim for whatever reason, I don't see why negligence can't come into the analysis.
Well, I guess I never – I mean, this is – if we were being sued for negligence, then I guess we'd have to look at that. Right now, what I'm looking at are assignments and with duties. You can't impose a duty on somebody without their consent. So those are the three basic arguments with respect to assignments, with respect to equitable liens. The laws and the cases say that for an equitable lien to arise, there must be no remedy at law and unjust enrichment. Two.
Mr. Becker, let me ask you the same question I asked of Mr. Erlinson. In handling the trust account on behalf of Ms. Hernandez, what fiduciary duty, if any, does Attorney Durkin have and to whom?
The duty is to his client. And I was going to give an example later, but maybe I'll give it to you now. Okay, and this kind of explains duties and delegations. Let's assume for a moment that I owe Dr. Jorgen $1,000. So I go to the bank, I cash my paycheck, I put the $1,000 in my glove box, and I drive home, and Mr. Durkin is there and says, I have an assignment from Dr. Jorgen to pay me that $1,000. I have a debt to Dr. Jorgen. I have a duty to him. He has the right to collect that. I come in, and Mr. Durkin says, I want my $1,000. You've got it in the glove box. Dr. Jorgen said, I have it there. He can assign that right. I have a duty that's imposed on me. I have a duty to pay him $1,000. That he can assign that right to Mr. Durkin. Well, let's say that Dr. Jorgen and I are out together, and he says, well, I'm going to go to the ball game tonight. I have $1,000 with me. I don't want to take it with me. I'm going to put it in the glove compartment of your car. I'll get it tomorrow. And now I pull into the driveway, and Mr. Durkin's there with his assignment saying, give me the $1,000 that's in your glove box. I have no right. I have no duty to Dr. Jorgen. I do not owe him $1,000. That's not my money. And that's what a trust account is. That's not the attorney's money. It belongs to the client. And when the client comes in and says, I want that money, I don't want to pay my bills, I believe my duty is to the client.
And when the client gives the attorney instructions to pay that bill, then what is that attorney's legal obligation?
I still believe there's a duty that's being asked to be imposed on the attorney. The attorney has no obligation to accept that. Now, it'd be no different than if I pull into the driveway and I say, look, you've got an assignment from Dr. Jorgen for this money. I don't want to get involved in your problems. That's your problem. I don't have to accept that obligation. And what if I pull in and Dr. Jorgen calls me and says, I gave this assignment to Durkin, but I changed my mind. Don't give him that money. It's not my money to give to him.
No, I understand that. Here's my problem. This is where I'm drawing a block.
Okay.
You say the duty is to the client. The client gives you instructions. You do not follow the instructions that the client has given you. What am I missing?
When the client changes their mind and says, my circumstances have changed. I know I'm responsible for that bill, but I want this money. I need it now. I think my...
Which raises the next question. Are there additional instructions in this record other than the instructions that we've been pointed to?
No. There was never any testimony taken in the trial court. I mean, if that argument is acceptable, if that's the distinction here, then I think we have to go back and it has to be remanded for further testimony, for further evidence. Again, the trial court. I mean, we brought a motion saying, look, it doesn't matter what the facts are. We never signed the lien. We didn't feel as a matter of law that we were obligated. Again, the court never really took any testimony on that. If that's an issue, then we would have to, it'd have to be remanded.
Mr. Durkin requested records from Dr. Jorgen?
Correct.
What authority was there for Mr. Durkin to do that?
Requested the records from Dr. Jorgen?
Yeah.
Well, he was given an authorization by the client to get obtain medical records.
Was that the same document that was the assignment?
No. No. When a client comes into our office, we have them sign documents authorizing us to obtain medical records. That's the document that we send to the doctor's office, and then we obtain the medical records from the medical care provider.
Now, did Mr. Durkin call or contact Dr. Jorgen about the size of the bill?
I believe he did. I believe they talked about it.
What was the authority for Mr. Durkin to do that?
Well, I can tell you, I assume, I mean, he has an authorization to discuss, to obtain medical records and discuss the medical condition or medical cases with Dr. Jorgen. I mean, I assume he had talked to Ms. Hernandez beforehand and went through what the bills were, and very often, we will call, if we have clients, letters of protection or not, we try to get bills paid. We encourage clients to pay bills. So when they come in, we say, these bills are outstanding as far as we know, and we try to get them paid. There are times what we'll do on behalf of the client is All Saints and Aurora are in Racine. They're very difficult to deal with. And what we'll do is we'll call them and say, can you reduce your bill if you get payment, you know, in full right now? And if they won't, again, we have no obligation to pay that bill for our client. We can tell the client they won't accept the reduction. What do you want us to do? We can pay the bill. We can give you the money. And if they say, give me the money, that's what we do. It's their money. Again, it's not for me to decide which bills they're going to pay.
Is the record clear when the settlement came in? Is the record clear on what kind of communication there was between Ms. Hernandez and Mr. Durkin?
No. Again, there was no testimony. No testimony provided with respect to that.
Do we know where Saul Hernandez is?
The last I know, she was in Illinois, but I don't know where she is. I mean, it's been years. I have no idea where she is now.
Here's the problem. It just seems unfair. Doctor gives medical services, chiropractic services. Then Ed gives the appropriate reports to the lawyer. On the basis of that, the lawyer gets a settlement amount, and now it's payout time. The lawyer is also aware of an agreement, which on its face looks okay, between the recipient of the services and Dr. Jorgen. And the recipient says, you ought to be paid out of the proceeds. It doesn't say how much because obviously the bill isn't final yet, right? Now, the lawyer is sitting there with these proceeds, knowing that Dr. Jorgen is entitled to something, right?
Correct.
And despite the fact that the client has a contract with Dr. Jorgen, which on its face seems valid, the lawyer releases the money. It doesn't seem right. Now, I can agree, I think, at least for argument, there is no contract between the lawyer and the doctor that the payments will be made. Might agree that there's no lien on the proceeds, not statutory, not common law. But there's something the matter with this. Is this the way we should be doing business in this state?
No, it's not. And let me explain a few things. I have been contacted by chiropractor's office before they start treatment. I've had clients go to chiropractors. They'll go in. The chiropractors will send me a lien. I've had calls from different chiropractor's offices, and they say, are you going to sign this lien? And what I tell them is no. And I tell them, here's why. We will try to get your bill paid. But when that money comes in, it was my understanding at the time. Now, again, you can tell me I'm wrong, but my understanding was that money belongs to the client. We can encourage them to pay that, but I can't take their money and pay your bill. We try to get these bills paid. Sometimes they slip through the cracks. Let me give you an example. I had a case where a chiropractor testified at trial. His bill came in for his testimony. We paid it. When the disbursement statement was signed and the money was dispersed, the bill for testifying was very close to his outstanding bill, and we missed it. I called him up. I explained it. I said, look, can we split the difference? He had no problem. He said, no, you don't have to send anything. I sent it to him anyway. Nobody's trying to cheat anybody out of anything here. We try to get bills paid. But when a client comes in and says, don't, we talk about the rules of ethics. I question, and I've written letters of protection, but I question whether that's providing financial assistance. If you're saying the attorney can be personally liable for a personal bill of a client, there's a question if that's even providing financial assistance to the client. Now, it's been, I know they've been used for years, and I have written letters of protection. But when I do, I call the client in, I sit him down, and I explain what it means. I says, you understand that if there's a settlement here, this bill will get paid, and you could end up with nothing. I write very, very few letters of protection. The last time I did was to a landlord. A woman was being evicted. She said, this is a priority bill for me. So I talked to the landlord. I said, the case should be resolved within a month or two. I can't guarantee how much we're going to get. I can't guarantee. If there's no recovery, I can't guarantee you anything. But if we get the money, I will pay you.
Did you have a lien? Was there a lien with regard to the landlord?
No, there was no lien. I wrote a letter of protection.
Is your analysis here, I assume it applies even if you were dealing with emergency dental care by a surgeon doing dental surgery and had the same kind of lien, it would be the same thing. Your response would be the same thing?
Sure.
Physical therapist?
Absolutely. If this is allowed to stand, what will happen is when people come in, see a doctor, they're going to be signing insurance forms, they're going to be signing medical liens, and then we can get liens from every different provider. You know, I gave the example in my brief about all the potential problems this could cause. Is it related? You know, is it pre-existing? And when we talk about equities, you know, should there, you know.
It's hard. When you talk about equities, it's hard because, you know, you can come up with fact situations. In central Wisconsin, where I live, it's difficult for low-income people to get any dental care, let alone emergency dental care. Let's say it's an emergency dental situation, person in a motorcycle accident, needs care. One of my concerns, and I don't know how to balance all this, it implicates an access to care, you know, health care. These instruments can be vehicles to health care. How does that enter into the equation for your position?
Okay, here's, first of all, like I said, a chiropractor can call me before he starts treating, before he renders treatment to the client, and call the attorney and say, are you going to protect this? If a client came in to me and said, my chiropractor, here's who I want to see, they won't treat me unless you sign a letter of protection, again, I would sit them down, I would explain the letter of protection, and then I would consider writing one.
In my hypothetical, we don't have the luxury of time, the emergency dental surgery.
I think you'd have a question about conscionability in that case. You know, you go to a chiropractor, you have time. I don't think this question is unconscionable. Mm-hmm. You go into an emergency room with your guts hanging out, and they have you sign a lien, and I don't know that there might be a question of unequal bargaining power in that case and whether or not that lien is conscionable.
Yeah, the other side of the coin is healthcare providers. You know, there are some doctors who take Medicare, for instance, that's a different type of lien, but there's a lot of working poor. You know, there's some healthcare providers who don't provide healthcare unless they know that they'll get paid. Now, you might say, well, that's immoral, or others might say, look, I can't do business without it. You know, I mean, I don't know where you come down on that, but it seems that in some ways this case has implications for access to healthcare.
It can't. I've been practicing over 20 years. I've never had anybody been refused treatment because I have not signed a letter of protection. Could it happen? Yeah. But I've never seen it. I'm not suggesting it couldn't happen. Could they go to another chiropractor? Probably. I would assume there's another one that would accept, you know, the treatment. Could it affect their health care? Possibly. And again, I filed a case yesterday, and I apologize for the lateness. I didn't, obviously, the Chiropractic Association filed their amicus brief after we had filed our brief. So I never really got to address the equitable lien arguments in my brief. And that case kind of summarizes everything. But again, yes, there are issues with that. But as that case pointed out, that's something that should probably be handled by the legislature. There's so many different complications there that could arise.
Mr. Becker, I have a clarifying question, a response that you gave to one of Justice Brasher's questions. I want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly. When Justice Brasher asked about the authority for obtaining the various records and whether or not there was the same document as the quote, doctor's lien, I think you answered they were two different documents, but maybe I'm misreading this. I'm looking at Appendix 46 of your brief and also page 3 of the Court of Appeals decision, and it seems that they're in the same document dated December 15, 1999. Is there a separate document besides that regarding authorization?
Oh, yes. Yes. That's not part of the record. I mean, again, we have our own forms that when a client comes in, they sign these forms so that we can get medical records.
So there's something besides this document?
It's merely an authorization to obtain records.
It doesn't have anything to do with paying out bills.
No.
Counsel, just to straighten out my thought process here, the assignor was Ms. Hernandez. She assigned her right to the doctor, and you supposedly became the obligor. In other words, there was tentatively or hypothetically an obligation for you to pay whatever sums you got to Dr. Juergen. If I correctly stated the lineup here as far as under the rule of assignments or not?
No.
Okay.
Because you delegate duties, you assign rights. She may have the right to assign the proceeds, but her claim to get those proceeds is from the insurance company. You can assign a right. If she has a right to receive money, as I pointed out in my brief, there's three different contracts here. Just like if I have $1,000 in my glove box, but it's not mine, somebody else put it there, I have no duty to Dr. Juergen to pay that, even if somebody shows me an assignment. She's trying to delegate a duty to the attorney, and the attorney has to accept that. I mean, again, I used to teach at Parkside. I taught business law, and I pulled out an old business law book. A delegatee must manifest a willingness to assume the duty. That wasn't done here.
Counselor, isn't the real beef here not only that the doctor wasn't paid, but that all of these funds were dispersed by Attorney Durkin? So, you know, his knowing about the assignment and in the face of that assignment paying all the money out, that's where I have the problem. I don't see how you can just ignore the assignment document and proceed contrary to it. He let it sit in his trust account and said, pox on both of you, let's take it to small claims and figure out who gets the money. That's fine, but it seems to me he took a very affirmative action that was really contrary to the assignment.
In retrospect, it would have been better to hold it and take this to court and try to resolve it that way. I will agree with you 100%. But the question is, was there a legal duty on Mr. Durkin to pay it to Dr. Juergen? And I don't believe there was.
Well, let me ask the question a little bit differently, because it goes right to the heart of that question.
All right.
When an attorney fails to follow the instructions given to the attorney by the client, what liability, if any, falls upon the attorney and to whom?
Well, you're assuming that there weren't conflicting instructions. You're assuming that the client doesn't come in at the end.
What's in the record? The record says there are instructions here. I don't have any other instructions.
I understand. First of all, if the client says, I want these bills paid, I don't think the attorney has the obligation to do it. You're delegating a duty. The attorney doesn't have an obligation. Now, we would. There's no question we would. But we are.
Is that part of the attorney-client relationship?
Paying off their bills?
No. In terms of following the instructions,
You're arguing the premise that the attorney had a duty to follow the client's instructions.
Absolutely.
The client has given instructions. What happens when the attorney doesn't follow the client's instructions?
You have an obligation to follow their instructions to some degree. I mean, if they tell you to do something that's improper, obviously you have the right to tell them no. If they have the right, if they tell you to do something that is beyond the scope of your representation, you don't. Now, I'm not suggesting, you know, if you start paying bills, legally, is that beyond, is that more than providing legal services? Maybe it is. I mean, we would never refuse to do that for somebody. But what, again, when they come in at the end and say, give us the money and we follow their instructions, that's what's happened. I don't know how much time I have here, but the one thing I do want to address, just briefly, before I get more, ask more questions, is the equitable lien issue. For an equitable lien to arise, there has to be unjust enrichment. There was a case, a federal court case, called Turner v. Moriarty, 25 Fed 3rd, 1356, where there was an attorney in Wisconsin, referred a case to an attorney in Texas, he settled the case. It's like a $1.5 million case, the fee agreement was 50-50. The attorney in Texas sent him a check for a third for $200,000 instead of $300,000. The attorney sued both the attorney in Texas and the insurance company, saying there was an equitable lien and you dispersed it. And the court there said the concept of an equitable lien is to prevent unjust enrichment. The insurance company paid the full amount of the settlement to the Texas court. Therefore, they were not unjustly enriched. So there are times when the chiropractor's bill is greater than the attorney's fees. So one thing, if you're going to grant an equitable lien, then you got to decide, okay, what is it for? Is it for the amount of the bill? Is it for the amount of the attorney's fees that the attorney has still retained? Is there any reduction for the fact that, such as in subrogation, if a subrogated party wants to participate, they get their own attorney, otherwise they have to pay a portion of the attorney's fees? Does the chiropractor have to pay a portion of the attorney's fees? I mean, so if we're getting into equities, those are things that we have to look at. Should we take the total amount that the attorney has left and say, well, the attorney has a lien. The chiropractor, if you're going to grant an equitable lien, has a lien. Maybe we have to divide it up some way. You know, if we're talking about equity, I guess we have to look at what is left and how do we divide it up?
Counsel, in that same vein, and perhaps this is a little off the subject, but quickly, if there's a dispute about the bill, and let's say to get the treatment, and I understand that if you have someone that doesn't have the money, they're not going to argue with the doctor, look, this fee is too high. But if they go back to the doctor, and I think there's something I read in one of the cases where if you go back to the doctor or chiropractor several times and you come up with, the last three visits weren't necessary, where does that dispute get fought out? I mean, we have the lien. You have the language. The attorney's got the lien. Is there no obligation for the attorney to enter? Is it simply a dispute between the recipient of the care, in this case Hernandez, and Dr. Juergen? In other words, if there is a dispute about the bill, and we're talking about equity here, where does that dispute take place?
Well, I think the only way to resolve that is to have a trial on it. I mean,
I just brought that up because in your brief you mentioned, well, you think maybe Hernandez should be in this in some way if we were to, say, rule that we want to send it back to the trial court and bring Hernandez into this as an indispensable party, or at least as a party who may have had some concerns about the bill. I don't know that, but I'm just saying that at some point in time, if there is a dispute, I don't think the attorney or the party, you can't solve it that way.
I agree. Yes, if you do have a dispute, let's say the bill's $5,000 and the client is saying, geez, I don't pay that because I think some of the treatment was unnecessary. We had a trial this year where we had $21,000 worth of bills. $18,000 was from the chiropractor, a physical therapist. Now, you know, when we run into those kind of problems, we get liens from the therapist. The insurance company offered $10,000. I think we ended up getting about 20-some at trial. We don't have enough to cover the lien even. And I don't think there's any question why that treatment was unnecessary. So, again, we run into the problem of how do we determine that. We're going to end up with, again, more cases in court with courts just deciding what's reasonable, what's unreasonable. Again, the example I gave in my brief had, you know, a number of different medical care providers, but you run into, is it related to the accident? Is it pre-existing? You know, how do you prioritize the liens if you're going to give liens? You run into all kinds of problems if you start granting equitable liens for these doctor bills.
I'm not quite sure what your advice would be to Dr. Jorgen about how he should have done this.
Well, I sympathize with Dr. Jorgen. I mean, in all due respect, there are some chiropractors in town who do run up extensive bills, and it creates terrible problems in trying to settle cases. Dr. Jorgen is not one of them. Again, we attempt to get our clients to pay. I mean, I sympathize with Dr. Jorgen, and I guarantee if I have another case, I would do everything in the world to try to get his bill paid. But legally, I just don't think that we are bound. We have an obligation to disperse that money to the client. It's their money. If he doesn't want to treat that person, if he doesn't want to take that risk, I think he needs to tell them up front, you either have to pay in advance, or I'll talk to your attorney and get this signed in advance. Again, I will sign letters of protection if the client comes to me and says, I need this. But I don't want, when they're just signing forms as part of, insurance forms, patient history forms, and then they put these liens in there, and they don't really know what they're even signing. If they come in and I explain it to them, I'm willing to countersign it for them as long as they understand.
Counselor, under what legal theory was Attorney Durkin paid and the predecessor attorney paid? How'd they get paid out of these settlement proceeds?
Because the statute, there is a statutory lien for attorney's fees. By granting a lien here, there is a statutory lien for charitable hospitals. To say that there's going to be something more for everybody else, you might as well wipe away that statute. Charitable hospitals have to go through a specific requirement to get their lien.
But don't you have to also have an underlying agreement with the client to make that payment for the lien to arise?
Oh, yes. Yeah, there's no question. I mean, again, that wasn't part of any testimony or evidence taken in the trial court, but definitely.
Okay. Was the check from the settlement payable to you and the client? That's
normally
not in the record.
Normally
that is.
Now, again, another potential problem is workers' compensation cases. If we're going to talk about that, the checks are not made payable to the attorney and the client. So if it's a workers' comp case, the attorney doesn't see the money. That check goes directly to the client. There's absolutely no way we could honor a lien, even though we're aware of it, it's out there. The money doesn't even pass through our trust account.
So you're saying a rule has to be if your client wants to be sure that Dr. Jorgen, for example, is paid, you have to sign off that he will be paid out of the proceeds to the extent that the proceeds are available.
Correct. I think any other kind of rule will just create complications.
And that's under contract law.
Under contract law.
Has to be written under the statute of frauds.
Yes.
Does Saul Hernandez know that Dr. Jorgen has not been paid? And if she does know, what is her position on this?
Yes.
She doesn't.
I don't know for sure. Again, I can only imagine that in a case like this, Mr. Durkin would have explained to her, these bills remain outstanding. You understand you have an obligation to pay these bills. I assume she knows it's outstanding. I believe Dr. Jorgen has attempted to contact her, and they are aware of it, and she has not responded, is my understanding.
Taking a judgment against her? Is that public record?
I'm sorry?
Has he taken a judgment against her?
I don't believe so. I think I've covered everything I wanted to cover. Maybe not in the order I wanted to. So if there's no other questions, I'll sit down.
That seldom happens here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Mr. Erlinson, you have several minutes in rebuttal. I think your client wanted us. It's not your client. I'm sorry. Dr. Jorgen wanted to talk to you, so. Have you done that? Okay, fine. I just wanted to be sure that since you attracted some attention, that it was done. Please tell Mr. Erlinson, one of you will make the rebuttal.
Chief, if I might, I don't believe Mr. Becker's red light had gone on. It yet had.
You want to ask him a question?
I do have an additional question to ask him.
All right.
And I'm going to ask the same question to Mr. Erlinson when he comes up. And it's pertaining to the last paragraph of the authorization and lien in Appendix 46 of your brief, Mr. Becker. Please acknowledge this letter by signing below and returning to Dr. Jorgen. Retain one copy for your records. I have been advised that if my attorney does not wish to cooperate in protecting Dr. Jorgen's fees, he will not await payment and will require me to make payments on a current basis. What effect, if any, does that have on the arguments that we've heard here today?
Well, I think that confirms everything that I've been saying, is that Dr. Jorgen wasn't relying on this to provide treatment to Ms. Hernandez. Again, we weren't aware of this until she was done treating. I mean, there are cases where we may not want to take a case if there's a lien and we have to deal with all these problems. There's some of these low-impact, soft-tissue cases where we just won't want to get involved. What if I take the case, do some investigation, take pictures, and I spend a year on the case, and then I get the records at the end, and lo and behold, there's these liens in all the records. I mean, am I bound to continue this case and to honor this lien when I may have turned it down in the beginning? I mean, again, here, this is saying, the chiropractor is saying, acknowledge this. And if you don't, I may not wait for collection. I mean, it was never acknowledged by our office or any other attorneys. I think it just confirms our argument.
Well, counsel, maybe this is answering my own question, but that's my question was, shouldn't Hernandez have been, maybe I should address the other side, but Hernandez is not in this case. And it would have been perhaps under the clause just referred to by Justice Butler, Hernandez perhaps should have been in this case as an indispensable party.
Without a doubt, she should have been in this case. Having difficulty serving somebody does not mean, that doesn't mean a person's not available. I mean, there's no, so again, maybe there'd be more proof necessary in the trial court, but there's nothing to suggest that any effort was made to serve her or to pursue any collection remedies against her. But definitely she should be part of the suit then.
All right, Mr. Becker, thank you. Mr. Erlandson.
Thank you, Your Honor. this is unfortunate, this case. But it's not a necessary bit of misfortune. The money was there. Mr. Becker pointed out on a number of occasions, it's the client's money. Correct. And the client had encumbered those proceeds. The duty was not delegated. The insurance company performed its obligation. It settled the case, paid the money, they were in the trust account, or wherever they were held, at the law firm. There was no insurance company duty delegated to Mr. Becker or Mr. Durkin. The only duty they had was a ministerial duty to disperse funds pursuant to the attorney-client relationship that they had with Ms. Hernandez. Ms. Hernandez had been very clear as to what her instructions were as to what should happen to this portion of the proceeds that were earmarked for Dr. Jorgen's bill. Now, there's been a question of, well, did Ms. Hernandez dispute this, and maybe she did. The record's clear. It was Mr. Durkin and his firm that moved for summary judgment. They put the facts in the record. Where it appears that the non-moving party is entitled to summary judgment based on the record as it exists, summary judgment can be entered pursuant to WSFAT Section 80208 sub 6. This is not a remand case. The record is the record. There's nothing about Ms. Hernandez disputing this amount in the record. Had there been, it would have been incumbent upon and totally appropriate for the attorneys to bring that issue up. It's a pretty significant issue.
Mr. Erlandson, if I could, let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Becker about that last paragraph in the authorization and lien. I have been advised that if my attorney does not wish to cooperate protecting Dr. Jorgen's fees, he, and I'm assuming that he relates to Dr. Jorgen, will not await payment and will require me to make payments on a current basis. What effect, if any, does that clause have on this case and the arguments we've heard?
I think that it underscores the fact that Ms. Hernandez received consideration for the assignment, that she was, in effect, getting some quasi-credit extended by Dr. Jorgen's office. I don't think that that paragraph creates or takes away any right or duty It's an assignment between Ms. Hernandez and Dr. Jorgen. I think as the obligor, the obligation arises from the attorney-client relationship, and the client's instructions were clear. As for the parade of horribles, that this is going to create chaos in the personal injury realm, it won't. The market will decide, and the market will take care of this. Firms like Mr. Becker's will make asking about these kinds of liens part of the checklist. They already ask about Medicare liens. They already ask about ERISA liens. It is better to know earlier about these kinds of agreements than let them wait, and a liability issue arises a week before trial and there's a chiropractor's lien and now the case has only half of its value. What do we do now? Everybody did the right thing. Everybody documented on the medical provider's side. And then a week before trial, they're asked to give up their rights or have their rights deemed non-existent because the attorney who did the intake of the prospective client didn't ask the question. Now, if there is some kind of lien agreement that exists that is going to devalue the case from a plaintiff's attorney's perspective, better to know it earlier. That way you can either refer the case out or get the chiropractor on the phone and say, this will not work, and here's why.
Does this create any conflict situations or settings for the attorney? We've already heard about the statutory lien referred to by Mr. Becker and how the attorneys got paid. Now you've got a pot of money that's in the trust account and different places where the money is supposed to be dispersed. The attorney, I'm assuming, is one place. The chiropractor is one place. The client wants his or her funds. Does this put the attorney in any kind of an untenable position?
No. Anytime there's a dispute over trust funds, the attorney has rights, duties, obligations. They're pretty clear. There's all kinds of mechanisms in the law that exist, declaratory judgment actions, interpleader actions. The attorney is not going to be left holding the bag, and the attorney has options in the event that legitimate disputes break out. The tools are already there. And the concept of equitable liens, as long as there's a debt, there's a writing, and the express intent is clear, an equitable lien arises. And allowing these funds to disappear, and then here we stand in this chamber wondering where Saul Hernandez is, that's unfortunate. That's very unfortunate, and it's equally unnecessary. And so trust the market. The market will take care of this. And deals will be made, and it will work out. But these rights should be respected and confirmed in the law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erlandson. Mr. Jorgen, thank you for appearing. We don't often get people who represent themselves, and you did very well, and we appreciate your taking the time and effort to do that. Mr. Erlandson, thank you for representing the association. And Mr. Becker, thank you for representing Mr. Durkin on what on its face was started out as a small claims court, is wound up here, and I'm glad there's no federal questions, so it's not going to go to the federal courts. That ends our hearing. Pardon me, Mr. Becker? Best not at this time. That ends our hearing on 2004 AP 1359 Jorgen versus Durkin. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning when it will hear all arguments again, and the court will meet in the conference room at 3:10 promptly.